Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zeslowski. I hope you've banked some of your time because you'll have some cool new ways to use it soon. This is episode number 77. Hello, I am glad you have joined me for this episode. And I want to express deep levels of appreciation for your time and attention. I'm just messing with you. You thought I turned into a robot, didn't you? Yeah, you did. Said in a different way, Joel Ease, if you will. Holy buckets, you rock. I'm grateful you've cranked me up. Before I say anything more, though, there's one person in particular that I want to acknowledge who's listening into this episode and probably has listened to all the rest and the ones that are coming. Tyler Lying. Hello. You deserve my gratitude for being willing to change and using this show to help make that happen. I know you recently wrote me a note thanking me for this podcast and explaining how it's changed your life. But when I see what you've done with your new mostlyminimal.net website, which I'll link to in the show notes, and I suggest people check out, and how brave, how vulnerable you're letting yourself be, man, I can't help but feel changed too. Sometimes to make progress, all it takes is just that one resource, a little sliver of hope, and then the courage to take a step forward. So thank you for inspiring me right back, Tyler. I tell you what, I'm about to get an uber dose of inspiration, not to mention a whole lot of hugs, high fives, some amazing paleo food, and the chance to hang out with some of the most amazing people I've ever met or will ever meet at World Domination Summit 2015. If you never heard of this event in Portland, Oregon, go back and listen to Smart and Simple Matters episode 54, and you're totally going to get it. I get on a plane with my wife, Melinda, and my two little dudes, Grant and Clark, in just a few days to fly to Portland for really two different experiences. The first will be a fun family vacation in and around Portland for 5 days. Then I'll take Melinda and the boys to the airport, and they will come back to Minneapolis. Me? I am going to stick around Portland for another 5 days and binge on conversations with my fellow WDSers. Sweet, sweet, sassy molassie. I could not be more stoked about my upcoming 10 days in Portland. Who knows? Maybe I'll do another podcast episode recap this year of the Portland experience if I feel like I can keep it in under about 10 hours. Always kind of tough when we're talking about WDS in Portland. Right now, it's time for you and me to be mindful, stay present, and enjoy our moments together. Because I have a Dipsy-Doo-Dunkaroo episode featuring Sosh Milne to bring you. She carved out a slice of her evening in her small Australian town to chat with me about how the invisible walls of privilege can come crashing down upon us. How to travel in a place instead of through it. How grocery store self-service checkout machines eat away at community. And of course, the economy of human connection. Believe you me, she makes up for a slight dip in her sound quality with a big boost to her idea quality. Let's take this Smart and Simple Matters dealio for another spin around the mental block, shall we? Here we go. All right, everyone. Wow. Big smile right now. I'm trying to contain my excitement. I have Sosh Milne, a 20-something Australian social change activist with a passion for local produce, strong communities, and alternative economies. After living much of her 20s in a remote village in Indonesia, she returned to Australia with a master's in social change and a unique perspective. Now, you can see some of that perspective in her design and implementation of grassroots sustainability projects, like a local community time bank, the Nothing New Project, and her theory of the economy of human connection, featured in her TEDx Perth talk. Sasha is also the writer and photographer at Inked in Color, a blog that follows her through her social change projects and catalogs, the pursuit of simplicity in an everyday life lived outside of the box. Now that's my kind of stuff. Sash, welcome to the show. I'm thrilled to speak with you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Let's start where I normally start, which is something I call the seeds of awesomeness. We want people to understand why you are the person you are today, and often that starts when we're growing up as a youth. So if you could tell us maybe one to two experiences that you had growing up, or maybe even something about your environment as a child that helps us understand who you are today.
Oh, gosh. I grew up in a really kind of normal suburb in sort of inner town Perth. I grew up in a pretty wealthy area. I had a pretty easy childhood. I traveled a lot when I was a kid. My mum's Canadian, so we spent a lot of time traveling in between Australia and Canada. And somewhere in there, I started to sort of see that the way that I lived was not the way that everybody else lived. When I was an early teenager, my parents split up and the entire way that I lived changed. The schools that I went to changed, the areas that I lived in changed. And I think for me, that was a really formative time in my life where I realized that the things that we have and the things that we want and our context of life can change. Maybe just a few sort of moments that you don't necessarily have any control over.
Sure. Well, before we get to maybe one of those moments, can you tell me, what do you mean when you said the way that you lived isn't the way that the rest of the world lives? Can you give us an example?
Well, I guess when I was little, I wasn't really, like my small children, really, I wasn't really aware of the privilege, I guess, that I had compared to other people, the privilege of an ease to access of education, or a privilege of the ease to access of food and clean drinking water and all of those sort of things that in my world were just a given. And the more I kind of ventured into travel and into reading and education and that sort of stuff, I realized more and more that just the true privilege that I've been brought up in, I think.
So about those moments, though, you said things can change in just a few moments. Is there something in particular that sticks out in your head as the crystallizing force, if you will, that got you down the path? Or maybe was it just a linear progression of one thing leading to another? Or was there this one big moment that just totally brought it into focus for you?
It was probably a whole lot of different things, but I truly started to look at my life differently after I traveled in India in my early 20s. That would have been for me. I came back from India a very different person than I was when I got there.
How so?
And that was perspective. It was perspective. It was you can read all of the books and you can study. I was studying international politics at the time. You can study all of the things and read all of the theory, but until you've actually volunteered and worked in areas that you've been reading about in slum cities, and until you actually see it and you talk with people and you meet people and you gain a whole different perspective for other worlds and for the way that other people live, I think you can't help but come back from that a completely different person.
Yeah. It's kind of hard. There's no apples to apples comparison here, but I've had a couple of experiences in terms of just observing fundamentally different worlds, different cultures, different languages, and sometimes in a volunteer perspective too, which traveling through a place versus setting up shop in a community for a period of time with the intent to help, to volunteer? I mean, those are very different things. When you said, did you volunteer in some of the slums in India?
Yeah, I did a little bit of volunteer work while I was traveling through. My intention was not to volunteer so much as it was to see and experience the place. After a week there, I felt like I had to do something, and it seems like it's such a privileged thing to say, to be able to see things like that and to feel like you had to do something. But I would just go to small schools, go to orphanages, and I would just show up and I would say, hey, I want to help. I'm here. What can I do? Anything. Just tell me what you need me to do. And I had a very different experience in India that way, but it was something that I'll never take for granted. I was very lucky to have that experience.
What were some of the things that they were just absolutely stoked to have you help them out with?
Oh, I just did things like read stories to kids and swept floors and served meals in orphanages and things like that. Really basic stuff. It was just, for them, it was an extra set of hands. And they were pretty stoked to have somebody else there, I think.
That's
great. It was a simple but really, I think I was 21 when I was there, and it was a really formative thing, I think, in my life.
So let's go forward a little bit too. I know you said travel is a fundamental part of who you are. You've been in Australia for a while now, but before that, you were in Indonesia for what? I think about
That's
3
right.
years, is that right?
Yeah, just over 3 years.
Okay, so I know there's a great story behind that. Maybe first we can start, how did you end up in Indonesia?
I was finishing my degree in Melbourne at the time, so I studied my tertiary education in Melbourne. And I used to work as an actor, a theatre actor. And so that's all I'd done for probably 10 years of my life since my teens. I'd only ever worked as an actor. It's all I'd ever wanted was to be an actor. I put so much of who I was into that. And the arts industry is a really tough one to break into, and it's a really hard world, and I was not strong enough to take it. I wasn't. I was far too sensitive to be able to actually hold my ground in that world, but I didn't know how to get out of it. And I figured the only way that I could break the cycle and find something else that I was passionate about was to actually remove myself from my world and to remind myself that there were other things that were much more important. So I went to a remote village in Indonesia. That was, to me, seemed like a really good idea at the time. But Indonesia is really close to Australia. It's really easy to access. It's easy to come in and out of for Australians. So, you know, it's only 3 hours from my hometown by plane to the capital city of the island that I was living on. So in that respect, it was accessible for me at the time. And I've never been to Indonesia before, which is strange for an Australian, because most Australians spend quite a lot of time in Bali in particular. But I went to Java, which is a totally different island, totally different culture, and went to a village that was about a 10-12 hour drive from the airport in the middle of nowhere. And I thought that if I went somewhere where I couldn't access anything that I had ever known before, that I would be forced so far out of my comfort zone that I would learn something about myself and something about the world. And I planned to sort of go for 6 months. And I came back to 3 years later.
Well, mission accomplished, it sounded like. You got there and you did thrust yourself into this very uncomfortable position. As you started to embed yourself in the community, things shifted rapidly. Before we get there, as you drive those 10-12 hours from the airport and you get to this small village, you step out of your vehicle. What are you feeling initially?
Combination of excitement and absolute terror, I think. That's generally my emotions anytime I land in a new place. It's because I just have no idea what to expect, and I have no idea how to communicate with people. And it's massive culture shock. It's massive culture shock. And for me, the culture shock was pretty huge. And yeah, my first reaction was kind of like, oh, what have I done? How am I going to do this? And, you know, and I fluctuated in and out of that state probably for the entire 3 years to some degree. But it's a bizarre thing trying to assimilate into a culture that is so different to the one that you've always known. It's a massive kudos to people who do it all the time and who attempt to assimilate into Western cultures and stuff. It's a very difficult thing to do.
Well, to paint the picture for people, I know I've heard you speak about this in other places. You talked about the utilities being completely unpredictable. Things that most people, at least in more affluent countries or cultures, take for granted. You were washing your own clothing. You were harvesting own rice in this small fishing village. All these things that you never had to do before. And of course, you can't necessarily... there are some things you could probably figure out. I could probably figure out how to wash my own clothing. But harvesting rice, like fishing, providing sustenance, nourishment for myself, I need somebody to teach me how to do that. So you had to find people, and you need to make friends and be a part of the community in order to do that. How did that progression go in terms of getting these people to accept you and teach you and then ultimately becoming one of them?
It started with language. I had to learn the language. So it really started there. I mean, we have this funny thing in the Western world where we like to just kind of learn everything from books or from the internet and, you know, to really educate ourselves. But for me, language doesn't work like that. Like I had my How to Learn Indonesian book and my Rosetta Stone thing on my laptop, and I found that it just didn't work. Like I actually had to go out and put myself in the marketplace and learn how to swim in terms of the language. And the Indonesian culture is such a beautiful one. And I was the brunt of so many jokes for such a long time because I was the funny little white girl who had absolutely no idea how to say anything and who was asking for pineapples when she meant bananas and didn't know how to count and couldn't ride a motorbike. I was the village entertainment for quite some time. And over that time, I learned through many, many mistakes and many misinterpreted conversations. But people were really good to me, and they were really, really patient with me. And all the time, while laughing at me, on one hand, they were helping me with the other. So I learned not to take myself so seriously. I think that was the first lesson.
That is a really important skill.
It was a big one for me to learn, was not to take myself so seriously. Yeah.
Well, the language that you used, putting yourself in the marketplace, I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I know some of the context behind it is that finding community in the marketplace. And you've spoken about this in other places where every transaction that you had was an opportunity for conversation. I mean, imagine that.
Yeah. Like
being in the marketplace and sure, you're exchanging money for goods, but as opposed to it being a purely financial transaction, it's a social transaction too. It's a way to build goodwill and to build community. And the contrast in Australia, in the United States, the marketplaces that a lot of people think about, those incredibly sterile strip malls, lots of transactions going on, but no.
And I imagine you guys have all the self-serve checkouts that we have here, where you don't even have to talk to a person anymore. You scan your own stuff and pay a machine.
Yep, they're becoming more and more popular.
Those are becoming more and more popular here too. So it's sort of like, in Indonesia, in village marketplaces, it's a barter system. Like, there's no set price for anything, right? So it has to be a conversation. And if you can't speak the language and you can't have that conversation, you will pay 10 times what you should actually pay for that bunch of bananas, because it is a conversation. Along with that conversation comes village gossip and stories about what they've done and who's bought what today and who was wearing that thing and who was riding what motorbike. And you can't just like drop into the market to grab a bunch of bananas and jump out again. Like, if you're going in there, be prepared to be there for at least an hour.
Yeah, it's a commitment.
You've got no choice. It's a part of being a part of the community. It's the hub of the whole community. And everyone goes there on a daily basis, because there's things like electricity is completely unpredictable. So whilst we had a fridge, it was not particularly useful. So you go and you get your fresh produce on almost a daily basis for whatever you are preparing that day. So it's a real contact point for everybody.
Absolutely. Well, this is why I'm so excited to talk to you, is because when I think about the crossroads of community and simplicity, you are one of the first people that comes to mind. And that, I love that. I mean, what we're trying to do with this Simple Rev movement that we have in the U.S. that's starting to branch out to places like Sydney and other places, that's where it is.
Yeah.
That intersection of community building and simplifying your life. I mean, they are so intimately tied, and you know this better than most. So moving along a little bit in terms of the story,
mm-hmm.
you were in Indonesia for 3 years, and yep. you finally found that deep sense of community that I think as human beings, it's just primal. It's in us. Like, we need that, and we deprive ourselves of that for sometimes decades, maybe even a lifetime.
Yeah.
But all the while, yeah. we need that, and sometimes we don't get to experience it. You did, and then you had yeah. a big change in your life. All in the span of about 6 months, where it prompted mm-hmm. to move back to Australia. Do you want to tell us yeah. a little bit about that, or do you want to just talk about when you got back to Australia a few years ago?
Oh,
what's been going on since then?
Look, there was a series of life things that happened, a series of personal sort of tragedies that happened, and the situation was that I couldn't stay there anymore. So I came back with my daughter, who was 9, 10 months old at the time. And because the move hadn't been kind of planned or thought out particularly much, and I was working as a freelance writer and doing my master's while I was living there. So I was only making enough money to support my lifestyle in Indonesia, which is nothing compared to what it costs to support a lifestyle in Australia. So I had no money, and I had no idea where I was going to live and no kind of plan. I ended up sort of landing in Australia completely out of my depth all over again and having to re-assimilate into the culture that I'd been raised in. So I ended up in a regional town where I had never lived before, where I didn't know anybody, and sort of started all over again. It was a very, very strange experience because I really struggled re-assimilating back into Australia. I found it really confronting to try and live the way that I had lived before.
I would imagine you quickly realized that you couldn't live the way that you had before.
No.
All these different perspectives, your travels through India, being in Indonesia for 3 years, coming back home and having it feel almost like a foreign place. You're trying to connect with people who don't share your experiences, who don't share your new mindset. They have different priorities in life. And it sounds
yeah.
like it was pretty tough to find a place where you felt like you belonged.
I felt completely ostracized from what should have been, I guess, my own world, I guess. It's the culture that I grew up in. It's the country I grew up in. I understand how all the systems work here. Nothing here is foreign to me. I know how to access the things that I need. I know where to go to get them. I have a license. I can drive on the roads. I understand how the tax system works. There's no, people aren't going to ask me for bribes to do things for them like they do in Indonesia. I get the system here. It's not a surprise. But for me, I didn't feel comfortable in it. Whilst there were things that I appreciated a lot, like a washing machine and hot water and electricity and those sort of things, I got used to having those again very quickly. It was that real personal disconnect that I really struggled with. And I had no idea how to connect with people. Like, I didn't understand how there was this huge disconnect in communities that I had never really seen before. I had lived in Indonesia. I just didn't see it. I guess I wasn't looking beforehand. But it became really obvious to me that we didn't kind of have community hubs where people could go to meet other people, and that people weren't so willing or open to making new connections. And for me, I just had no idea how to find other people.
Well, you know where you didn't find it. You didn't find it in those strip malls or the shopping malls that I was talking about. I know you didn't find it in the self-service checkout lane. Can you? This is such a great story, and I can't pass up the opportunity to have you just talk about it briefly here. Okay, you and your daughter Bo are shopping on Christmas Eve in this giant shopping center, and you talk about this in your TEDx a bit. I'm going to link to that in the show notes and some of the other things that I've been seeing you in and talking about. There's a wealth of information, but more than that, perspective that you can provide to people. So give us a little bit of that perspective. So there's jingles about joy and happiness filling the department store, and you're feeling what?
Well, yeah, so in Australia, Christmas time's really hot, right? So everyone's in shorts and t-shirts, and it's stinking hot outside. And so in Australia around Christmas time, you go to the shopping mall, not necessarily to shop, but because it's air-conditioned. And it's cool, so you go in there. And we were in there around Christmas because we didn't really have anywhere else to be. And so I didn't really know what to do. And so I knew there were people there, so we were just sort of there. And, you know, as you walk around, of course, you look like a total weirdo if you're not putting things into your shopping cart. So you're just sort of walking around with this kid in this shopping cart, putting sort of things in. And there's a constant stream of, you know, Christmas music about how happy everyone is being together and eating together and all of this stuff. And I'm just looking around at all of these people and everyone just looks really angry and miserable and stressed. And people are just sort of pushing each other out of the way and kids are screaming. And I just thought, oh my gosh, how have we got this wrong? That a shopping center is so full of people at what's supposed to be the happiest time of year where everybody comes together and it's all about being together and everyone's here just miserable. There's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way.
And did you feel miserable too? I mean, were you part of that or was that something where there was that disconnect between your perspective and everyone else's? You were, when you hear it's the most wonderful time of the year, you were thinking, yeah, of course it is. I mean, I'm experiencing it. This is wonderful. And everyone else, what's up with you?
I don't know. Christmas has never been a really big thing to me. So I was just, like, I wasn't unhappy. I felt like I was watching, like, a really bizarre sitcom. I feel like it was like I was watching my world with completely different eyes and just amazed that our culture has come to such a point where consuming things is actually seems to be more prioritized, more valuable than actually connecting with other people. And it was just watching that it all kind of in my head consolidated. And I just thought, no, I'm not going to be part of this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. So I decided that I wouldn't buy anything at all for 12 months and that I would force myself out of my comfort zone.
And you called that the whole not buying anything for 12 months, the nothing new project, right?
Yeah. The nothing new project.
And that was based on your experience in that shopping center on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
So you decided, hey, I'm not going to buy anything new for 12 months. And then you were writing about it. Obviously, you're a fantastic writer, and I've loved what I've seen of you online with the writing. But I've also heard you talk about, I think it was on Greg Berg's interview, A Life on Purpose, that you really didn't feel like you had much to write about during your Nothing New project because it didn't really feel all that challenging to you. Why was that?
I'm not sure. Like, when I thought I would do it, I put very little planning into it. And I thought, okay, like, I'm going to do this. It's going to be really hard. I'm going to have lots to say. It's going to be a really interesting kind of social experiment. There'll be an awesome opportunity, a platform to have these conversations. I know about 6 months in, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've got nothing to say. This is really easy. The first 3 or 4 months were hard, but then you just find a different rhythm in your life that isn't about, like, we just didn't go to the shops anymore. It's pretty liberating to not go into the shops. I tell you what, it's hard to get back into them after a year when you've managed to live alongside them and never walk through the doors. But
where were you spending your time instead?
With other human beings on farms, at the beach, in the bush, just in nature mostly. The whole process of not buying anything forces you to connect with other people, because of course there's things that we need or things that you're looking for, and there's holes in your life and you feel the need to fill them. And when you can't fill them with stuff, which seems to be the kind of default in our affluent society, you have to look a little harder. You have to make a bit more effort. When you start doing that, you find that life becomes pretty full of really great stuff, like new friends and community and people and community projects and volunteering and time. There's so much time for the things that really excite you.
Yeah, we're going to talk about community projects, especially those around time, because I know you have a really cool one that you are working on right now. One thing that I want to mention first, though, so I read this from your ABC Open blog post about how you first thought of your Nothing New project as just some personal activism against consumerism.
Yes.
But then you had the gears started shifting in your mind a little bit, and you thought that if the project was about something bigger, about building community.
Yes.
And how you get these strong communities of people, and our need to consume dramatically decreases without us really doing much at all. We can borrow things that we previously would have bought. That's the premise of the share economy and collaborative consumption.
Yeah.
We're able to exchange, and as you know extremely well, every single exchange is an opportunity to connect with people. And then those connections, you build relationships, and those relationships, both the ones that you're directly involved in and the ones that you facilitate and spark with others, that's how true communities are born.
Yeah, it's pretty magical stuff, hey?
It is pretty magical stuff.
Yeah, it's really simple.
Well, one of the things that you did is pay what you want garage sale. Was that your idea, or was that someone else's idea to have this pay?
That was just my idea. I've been visiting like a few. There's some farms sort of within a half hour radius from my place that still do honesty box kind of fruit and veg from their farms. And I visited one of them one day, and I thought, God, like, wouldn't it be great to just take all the stuff inside my house and put it out the front and get rid of it? You know, because I hate the idea that we spend too much money on storage systems to, like, pack away all this stuff that we never use, but we all hold on to just in case one day we might want it again. I don't like the idea of all of this useful stuff just sitting around in a cupboard when someone else who might actually need to use it could be using it. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to just take all of the things in my house that I don't use, and that I don't need, and just put it out there and put kind of like an honesty box and put no prices on anything and just tell people to come, and if they need it, just take it. And if they want to pay what they think it's worth, they can chuck some money in the tin. And I like the idea of just trusting the good and the honesty in people. I think people are generally pretty great if you just sort of trust them.
I agree. Sometimes... Yeah, you just need to set up the atmosphere. It just takes one or two people in a community to set the tone, to say, we are people who trust each other. We are folks who are generous. We may take, but we're give-oriented. So it sounds like you play that role as a catalyst now, where you travel in the communities that you're interested for other people who want to be that spark for others, who want to set that tone of the goodness and the trust in people. Is there one or two mindsets, or maybe even one or two communities that you know of, whether it's in person or online, that they can join to start reorienting our default in the world, as opposed to one of generosity, one of trust, as opposed to one of hoarding and one of, you know, mistrust?
I think if people really want to do it, then the online world is really great, and it's a really great tool for sharing information, and it's a really great tool for connecting with other people. But if you actually want to change the way things are, you have to start where you live. Like, you have to actually go and do it. You have to be that person. I found that sort of personal activism is the, hands down, the best social change tool that there is. If you actually are that person, if you give more than you take, if you offer to help other people, and not just offer, but actually just go and do it and show people how easy it is to do it. And I think the more that you are exactly the change that you want to see in the world, the other, it really, it sort of just follows. In terms of community kind of groups. I mean, every community is a little bit different, but any sort of growing group, organic group, permaculture-based group, the permaculture principles are wonderful, and they all fall into the same sort of line. And most communities around the world now have permi groups. I'm quite involved in one here, and those principles of connection and giving and reciprocity and generosity are so fundamental to the way that people who live under permaculture principles operate, that it's a really great way to meet like-minded people, I think.
What I think I'm hearing is that in order for me or for any of us to participate in what you call the economy of human connection, fantastic phrase, by the way, you need to do it where you are in your local community physically. Tell us, so the economy of human connection. Okay, when I heard about this concept, I've heard similar things, but I haven't heard it phrased that way. What's your definition of this concept?
Well, the basic definition of the economy of human connection is, as an alternative economy, is that the human connection comes before the financial gain. That is the foundation of it. So whilst we live in an economically driven world, and I'm not saying that our financial economy system should disappear entirely. I just think that we need to build upon the system that we already have and better it by connecting more with each other and by putting our priority in the connection, the human connection, before the financial engagement, whether it be giving or receiving. And that's as simple as if you shop at a supermarket, making eye contact with your cashier, having a conversation with other human beings, supporting locally produced products, supporting local farmers, going to places where you can actually talk to the people who make the produce that you buy, and actually, you know, really facilitating those community connections and talking to your neighbour and sharing what you have, those basic fundamental ways of approaching your own economic situation, I think are really, really important to live the economy of human connection. Really important.
I'm absolutely with you, but I am a big time extrovert. So what you're proposing here doesn't sound hard to me at all. I mean, that's what I do every day. I see somebody who seems interesting and I start talking to them. It's easy because I'm endlessly fascinated and curious and I love constantly engaging people. But for folks who are shy, who maybe don't necessarily have, I'm not saying they lack social skills, but they lack the desire to constantly be engaging people in conversation where they are. Mm. I know that it's a lot easier to talk to people when you know that you share things in common, whether it's background or values. Do you have one or two go-to ways to strike up a conversation with somebody in your community to feel them out, to see if they're your kind of people or if they are also a member of the economy of the human connection? How can somebody who needs some social lubrication, if you will, start that conversation?
Oh, gosh. I don't really know if I have an answer for you for that one, Joel. Like, I think I don't really know if there's people who are my kind of people and people who aren't my kind of people. I'm an introvert myself. I'm not a huge fan of large social situations. I quite like not going a day or two without having a conversation. But I think it's really important to it's just breaking down a lot of our modern barriers to connections. It's little things, making eye contact. And I think the really big one is that supporting local organizations, local businesses, local farmers. I mean, you don't necessarily need to have something in common with your local farmer. He grows carrots, you eat carrots. That's enough in common to actually just have a really simple transaction, human transaction, where you're actually connecting with the person before you're connecting with the produce.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So what I hear you saying is that you don't just randomly go up to people and say, "Hey, so how about those alternative economies, huh? You like time banks?
No.
Yeah, time banks. No.
I think, you know, not everyone's going to be your best friend, and you're not all of a sudden going to have a community of hundreds of people who you're really intimately connected with, because that would be really exhausting for any of us. I mean, that would be a huge responsibility. I think it's more about just recognizing that the people who grow the food that you eat, who make the things that you buy, that they're actually human beings. And I think we live in a world where we make so many of our transactions online or through a self-serve checkout, where we don't actually connect with the person, the actual human being behind the product that we're buying. And I think if we try and make that human connection first, and it doesn't have to be making a new best friend, it's just making a human connection.
I gotcha.
You know, eye contact, a shake of the hand, thank you for this product, you know, what's new in season, what are you growing this week, you know, what's coming up, that sort of thing, just to connect. And that's how communities are built. Communities aren't, you know, hundreds of people who are all best friends and who all have dinner at each other's houses every night of the week. Communities are people who live in a place that is safer for knowing each other, for recognizing each other, so that they're not so isolated.
Right on. Well, you said it well. A community is a place where the desire to share is greater than the desire to own. And I think it's so simple. And just with the one sentence, if people take nothing else away from our conversation, just thinking about that, a community is a place where the desire to share is greater than the desire to own. And as far as what you are personally doing to facilitate that in your local community, when I mentioned time banks just a moment ago, we were talking before we started recording about your development project and your community building exercise through time banks. So I'm interested in a couple of the details about it. But first, I know there are a number of people who are listening who they're thinking, time, what's a time bank? I go to a bank and they have money and that's where I get that. But can you tell us first, what's a time bank?
A time bank is a bank that you can really love as opposed to a bank that's just going to charge you lots of fees. Time banking is a way of trading skills in a community. So instead of money, time credits are used as payment. You earn credit for the work that you do for other people, and then you use your credits to buy another member's time to get services that you need. So the very key to time banking is that everybody's time is valued equally, that no matter what skills are used, no matter what work is done, that 1 hour of work is always equal to 1 hour of time credit. So it's very similar to a skill swap, except the use of a time credit means that you do not have to have a direct trade with one other member because you're using credits throughout the system. So I may offer a skill to you and you would then pay me a credit, and I may use that credit to get my next door neighbor to water my plants while I go away for the weekend. I would pay them that credit, and then they can use that credit to purchase time from someone else to walk their dog or help them do a graphic design project for them, or a multitude of different things.
All right. So the way that you are doing it, though, you just opened up a time bank in Australia.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's going really well. I'm super excited. You had this trial for about 25 families first. How did that work? Mm-hmm. How did you get everybody in and orient them in terms of the ethos behind it and how the process actually worked?
Okay, so we set up the time bank with a working group of five community members, and each of us invited 4 or 5 families who we knew would be engaged in the process, who we knew were community-minded and would be really interested in engaging, because for us we wanted the trial to be quite a controlled group so that we could fix any bugs that may come up along the way with the systems that we've developed. So we run orientations where people come to us and we have interactive conversation about what time banking is, how time banking works. But a lot of the time we actually focus on people's skills and passions, because a lot of people that you talk to time banking about say, oh, well, it's a really great idea, but I don't have any skills that anybody else would want. That tends to be the kind of fallback for a lot of people, which I think is really sad because everybody has lots of great skills.
Absolutely. Isn't that strange? People, whether it's cultural or social or intellectual, I mean, there's so many different kinds of skills that people have, and yet we don't value ourselves enough or stop to think long enough, what is it that I can offer my community?
So we talk about that exchanging skills is not solely about economic exchanges, that some of our skills are emotional or spiritual. We have people offering meditation classes or yoga classes, that it's not necessarily just things that we would pay for, that there's an enormous kind of social exchange. And for us, the time bank that we've set up is really, really focused on what it brings to us and to our community as individuals, as opposed to what we get for free.
Yeah.
So we don't put a lot of energy into, oh, well, you know, you can get that guy to fix your car and that would save you $500 from the mechanic. We talk about that, you know, Ben had come over to fix your car and now you know Ben and he lives three streets away and you didn't know him before and your extended community has just grown. And now you've got a friend who can do something really useful and, you know, Ben works away and he doesn't have much, you know, works really long hours and you can drop him a meal once a week and he would really appreciate that.
Or you can learn things from Ben too. Eventually, maybe even you can learn how to repair your own car. You're not trying to make Ben obsolete, but the knowledge transfer, the skills transfer too, that can be facilitated. I haven't participated in it formally, but I have friends who have done it, and they say that in itself can be amazing. If you're willing to learn, if you're willing to engage and build community, all of the amazing byproducts that happen as a result of it are just super cool too.
It's enormous. It's a really wonderful, really wonderful thing to bring people together who wouldn't necessarily have kind of found each other any other way, because there's such generational gaps and experience gaps and all of that sort of stuff. It's really wonderful to watch those sort of intergenerational friendships take hold. It's a really beautiful thing, I think.
It is. Well, here in the U.S., there's a website called timebanks.org, which helps people join an existing one or maybe even start a new one. And I think internationally, I've heard of one called ourworld.org, our as in H-O-U-R for time. You're familiar with both of these. For people who are really interested and they want to get started, should they go to one of those two websites, which I'll link to in the show notes?
Yeah, I mean, we used both of them when we were setting ours up. Our World is an online system, so they have a lot of programs on there that help you learn how to set up a time bank, but then they actually run an operating system that helps you log your hours and works as sort of an administrational system. The other is Community Weaver, which is the one that we use. They're both really great. Timebanks.org is a wonderful resource, and we've used it a lot to help us to set up our time bank, and there's a lot of really great research material on there to really understand how this particular sort of form of alternative economies works and some of the best ways to implement them in diverse sort of communities.
All right. Wow. So from a life of affluence to making yourself intentionally uncomfortable, all this travel... Shifting from a theater actress to a community builder and organizer, you have covered a lot of ground in a pretty short period of time. Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you would like people to know?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I don't think so.
All right. Well, hey, like I said, we covered a lot of ground in our time talking.
Yeah.
I'm super grateful that we've had this conversation, and I know a lot of other folks are, as I publish this in the future, are going to be really grateful too. For people who want to find out more about you online or who want to follow your journeys, your travels, your mindset shifts, where can they go?
The best place is to go to my blog, which is inkedincolour, colour.com. I post lots of links and lots of information on there. That's the best sort of one-stop shop to find access to the stuff that I'm doing.
So Twitter, Facebook, all those other outposts that you have.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
they all use the Inked in Colour name, so it's all just at Inked in Colour on both Facebook and Twitter.
All right. Well, again, Sash, truly, I'm happy to have this conversation, but even more so, I'm happy that there are people like you in the world who represent the goodness in people, that implicit trust that we can have for folks, and who are doing really cool things, both in their local community, but inspiring people around the world to take on other projects in their own way, in their local community or online too. So thank you a ton for being my guest, and thank you a ton for being who you are.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. That was Sosh Milne at Inked in Color, giving you plenty of brain food to get started. I don't know, maybe growing your own food. I really dig her perspective on permaculture, pun intended, the economy of human connection, and the crossroads of community and simplicity. You can find all the resources we spoke about, time banks, her TED Talk, and more in the show notes at valueofsimple.com/SASM077. I gotta say, Sosh would be perfect to participate in Simple Rev 2015, but I don't know too many Australians who are going to make it to our two-day workshop-focused Simple Living Community event in Minneapolis on October 2nd and 3rd. We do plan to welcome people from across the world, though, to our second ever event. And if you've heard me talking about it for months, and you think to yourself every time, dude, you know, I should really get a ticket to this thing. Well, then make today the day. Go to simplerev.com/tickets to see all the awesomeness you'll get when you join us and consider finally pulling that trigger. I bet I could give you 100 reasons why it will be worth it, but I'm really hoping you'll create your own. Speaking of events, one more thing before my sound waves part your lovely mind. One of the friends I'll be seeing at World Domination Summit, Emily Wapnick of PuttyLike.com, who you may actually remember from episode 26 of this show, just had her TED Talk about multi-potentialites published. As you know, I am a multipod, a proud one. I speak often about them and the concept itself, and Emily just absolutely nailed her TED Talk about it. Really, she sticks to only three easily absorbable items for her multi-potentialized superpowers. You're going to have to watch to discover them. Although, of course, there are tons more. She perfectly frames what's really at stake when she says that these three multi-potentialized superpowers might be lost if people are continued to be pressured to focus on their one thing, as if all of us only have one thing. And all these, the pressure, the traditional demands of everyone to specialize, if we continue to enforce them as a culture, as a society, it is to everyone's detriment. That's never been more clear after watching her talk. She says, as a society, we have a vested interest in encouraging multi-potentialites to be themselves. To that I say, darn tootin', Emily. I'm proud of you. You rocked it. You can watch her talk, and I encourage you to do so, regardless of whether you feel like you're a multi-potentialite or not. Check it out at valueofsimple.com/multi-TED. That's valueofsimple.com/MULTITED. You will also find a link to it in the show notes. Thank you once again for listening. just messing with you again. Let me try this another way. I am super duper uber grateful for your support, time, and attention. Let's do it, Sammy Sosa style. Keep it continuing. It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of All Things Value of Simple.